Hi, I'm DW from Houston.
I'm Kate Urquhart from Minneapolis.
I'm Jamie from New York City.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. John Oliver's from England, but he lives in New York. He served as the senior British correspondent on The Daily Show. Now he hosts HBO's Last Week Tonight. When he was on The Daily Show, he forged an eternal bond with one of his colleagues. Remember that England, John Oliver's home country, has basically no guns.
The first time I ever fired a gun, Rob Riggle, we were doing a stand-up show in Vegas together, and he took me to a gun range to fire my first gun. And when they put, for some reason in my head, I just thought they'd be like tied down or something.
Like a pen in a bank?
Yeah, basically. There'd be a chain. That it was a bamboozling moment that Riggle found extremely funny.
Well, Rob Riggle is a veteran.
And he was still in the service then. So he was wanting me to shoot all the guns that he'd shot. So he was like, it was like a tasting menu of firearms. Ah, here's a little something from Liberia you might be interested in. Something in a semi-automatic weapon used to suppress a local population. See what you think of that. Bang. Well, that felt awful. Next.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to John Oliver about why it can be weird to make jokes about American politics when you're a Brit. And I'll talk to him about how he got used to living in New York City.
I thought New York would be like a mixture of the Friends set and countless Woody Allen movies. And, you know, to a certain extent, I was not disappointed. And it was, I kind of fell in love with it straight away. Not just New York, but everywhere I went.
Then later, I'll talk to the host of The Nightly Show on Comedy Central, Larry Wilmore. He wrote and produced for The Bernie Mac Show, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and The Office. And, of course, he's also an alum of The Daily Show.
We saw The Daily Show as a way to kind of get paid training, you know, kind of work in front of the audience, build a rapport.
Paid training on one of the top five shows on television.
Exactly. You got to shoot for the stars, man.
Plus, the McElroy brothers from My Brother, and Me offer their advice on solo concert going. And I'll tell you about the greatest pop song ever written. Really. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. A few summers ago, John Oliver filled in as the host of The Daily Show while his boss there, Jon Stewart, was out making a movie. As it turns out, he wasn't just filling in. He was auditioning. And he got the part. His stint in the host chair was so successful that HBO offered him his own show. Now Oliver's starting up his second season of that show, called Last Week Tonight. It's a weekly half hour, a bit like The Daily Show, with some more deep diving. Oliver's a lawful permanent resident of the United States now, but he's originally from Britain. His outsider's perspective tends to inform his work. Here he is talking about the death penalty, which ended in the UK in the 1970s, but still has majority support there in the polls.
And here's the thing. Just because the British people don't have the death penalty anymore doesn't mean that we don't want it back. Recent polls suggest that at least half the population would choose to have it reinstated, which makes complete sense, because the death penalty is one of those things that is natural to want, but that you shouldn't necessarily have. The death penalty is like the McRib. When you can't have it, it's so tantalizing. But as soon as they bring it back, you think, this is ethically wrong. Should this be allowed in a civilized society?
John Oliver and I spoke last year.
John Oliver, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jesse.
So you're married to a citizen and are, as I mentioned, a lawful permanent resident.
I am. I believe we call ourselves a legal permanent resident group. That's the preferred term. It's a little offensive, what you just said there, Jesse.
Forgive me. I wonder if you've thought about whether to become a United States citizen.
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to yet. I think you have to be on a green card for a little bit longer for me to be eligible. So I'm not at a point where I have eligibility myself through my green card.
And you haven't looked into your own future at all? Are you just anticipating divorce? Is that what's going on?
Oh, no. Well, do you know what? Well, it's funny you should say that, because it was... I wanted to get my green card myself before I got married, just because, and this is, there is something, you know, basically ridiculous about this. I wanted to feel like I earned it and that I was wanted here. And this seemed, that is way too much emotion to put into a painfully bureaucratic process, but I wanted to feel like I had not married my way into the country, that I had kind of earned my way in. So, yeah, long term, I would like to find a way to maybe get dual citizenship or something of that flavor. I don't know.
Do you have like a style guide at the office where you decide when you're talking about people from the United States whether you say you or we?
It's funny you say that. I started gradually playing quite fast and loose with that at the Daily Show. That I came in very much with the you, and then gradually I felt that I earned referring to America as we when it suited me. So, and I have in the past in interviews, you can kind of wrong foot people. If in the past at the Daily Show when I was interviewing ambassadors, you can kind of basically play at both sides. You know, you can kind of, you can, they'll say something, you can find yourself basically taking the stance of, how dare you say that about us, and you're right, what is wrong with them? And that is quite a useful comedic hypocrisy to employ at times.
When you're doing a weekly show, you are obviously not as timely as a Daily Show.
Yeah.
And so it gives you a little bit of a different perspective. Did you think when you were developing this show about what you would do differently when you were, you know, making jokes once a week rather than making jokes every weekday?
Yeah, it's very different. There's a mental clarity that comes from working doing a show every day, because you don't have any time to wallow in your failure. You know, when I was sitting in for John over the summer, that I realized that there was a certain point of the day that I could wallow in failure, and it was walking from the desk at the end of the show to the rewrite room where we were going to start talking about tomorrow's show. So I had about 45 seconds to mentally beat myself up, and so that had to be quite a tenacious 45 seconds, and then you just kind of have to get on with it. And now it's a different mental process doing it once a week. So there, every part of it is different and is difficult in a different way.
You're also doing a full half hour of jokes. You know, you have a couple of, you know, video packages that are sort of sketches, but mostly...
But that's still, yeah, that's still produced content. Like you say, it is like it's 29 minutes, 58 seconds or whatever it is.
And so at least on the shows you've done so far, there's a significant amount of, here is 10 solid minutes of dissection of a particular thing. You know, that death penalty segment had to be a good 10 minutes long. And that's
probably, yeah.
That's a lot of jokes to write, and that's a lot deeper than you could. That would be basically all of an episode of The Daily Show that wasn't the interview and the, you know, headlines at the top of the show.
Yeah, I think it was actually, it might have been longer than 10 minutes. And at that point, that you can't do that on commercial television. You can't do 10 minutes about anything on commercial television in a half-hour show, because, no, if you've decided, oh, here's 13 minutes on something, you have to find a way to split that up, because Twix will have their say in the middle of that. Even though Twix are not going to be thrilled that they are the filling in a death penalty sandwich. I think just the length alone is slightly different to watch. That is kind of one of the fun things has been that you can really pursue an idea deeply and take the time and the space that you need for it. Another way of looking at it is to say you can beat a dead horse into the ground, but, you know, potato, potato.
It's Bullseye, and I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to John Oliver. In 2014, John graduated from senior British correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart to host of his own HBO show, Last Week Tonight. That show returns for its second season this week. When you first came to the United States, how much time had you spent here?
No,
I should say, when you first came to the United States to work for The Daily Show.
No time. Zero time. I had not been here before.
How did it compare with what you thought it was going to be like?
Well, I thought it would be like, you know, a mixture of... I thought New York would be like a mixture of the Friends set and countless Woody Allen movies. And, you know, to a certain extent, I was not disappointed. So, yeah, you know, you kind of project so much from all the cultural exposure you've had to New York and to America. It was, I kind of fell in love with it straight away. Not just New York, but everywhere I went. It was kind of, America is a confounding place, especially because it's projected as a... You kind of project yourself as a nation, or we do, to play fast and loose again now, as a united front to the world. Like I remember every time you watch the Olympics, you see Americans crying during their national anthem, waving their flags around. And it's, you assume, as a member of the rest of the world, that all of those Americans think the same thing about something, which is, of course, ridiculous. The fact is, they, at least two of them, probably have completely differing views on everything. And so, yeah, that's what I loved. The complexity of America is one of the things I loved the most about it.
What was the first place that The Daily Show sent you that was way, way outside New York to do a piece?
Chillicothe, Ohio. That was where. I can answer that before you even get to the end of that sentence. It was Chillicothe, Ohio, and I remember that because I'd never seen a gun before, and we were shooting in a diner, and a guy pulled up in a pickup truck, and he had a rifle in the back of his truck, and he walked in to the diner, and he left it there. And I remember thinking, oh my God, nothing about this seems normal. And I ended up talking to him while he was ordering something, and he refused to believe that I had never seen or fired a gun before. He just physically refused. He said, there's no way that's true. How old are you? And I think then I was 29. And he said, do you want to hold mine? I said, no. Absolutely not. This cannot be my first time with a stranger in Chillicothe. This can't be it. Because at this point, I still think there's a thing in my head that I might do something terrible with it.
You sort of felt that feeling that one gets when one stands too close to the edge of a cliff, that you might throw yourself off?
That was exactly it. I remember the first time I ever fired a gun, Rob Riggle, he was leaving The Daily Show, and we were doing a stand-up show in Vegas together, and he took me to a gun range to fire my first gun. And when they put, for some reason in my head, I just thought they'd be like tied down or something. Or, you know, they'd be tied down to the booth, the gun booth.
Like
a
pen in a bank?
Yeah, basically. There'd be a chain so that you couldn't... But this guy just presented me with this gun and, like, pointed me and they said, go on, shoot it. And that was my first thought was not, oh, I could kill people in here. My first thought was, I hope I don't... This is horrible, but it is that thing about not wanting to... You know, like when you're on a train platform, oh, I hope I don't jump in front of this train. It was that same thing of, well, I hope I don't just rotate my hand up 90 degrees and shoot myself in the head. It was just so hard to get my head around. I had no exposure to it. So it was just it was a bamboozling moment that Riggle found extremely funny.
Well, Rob Riggle is a veteran, and
yeah, he was a Marine. He is. He was still in the service then, so he was wanting me to shoot all the guns that he'd shot. So he was like, it was like a tasting menu of firearms. Ah, here's a little something from Liberia you might be interested in. Something in a semi-automatic weapon used to suppress a local population. See what you think of that. Bang. Well, that felt awful. Next.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the political satirist John Oliver. He's been a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and he now has his own HBO show called Last Week Tonight.
I feel like on your podcast, The Bugle, which is a really funny show.
Oh, thanks.
That you co-host with Andy Zaltzman, a very funny writer and performer with whom you've worked for many years. One of the big things that the two of you struggle with is the legacy of colonialism.
Yeah.
Andy is South African British.
Yeah.
And you spend a lot of time joking about the what Britain is in the world today and yeah. what Britain has meant historically. And I guess I just wonder, like, how that came to be what you were so focused on.
I don't know if we're focused on it. It's just that, like, whenever you... The problem is, like, if you want to make jokes about the news, so much of the time, if you follow the problems that any country in the world is having, it can end up coming back to something that Britain did. So it's a little tricky. If you see people fighting over a border somewhere, there may well have been a British man in the past who drew that border on a straight line across a map while sitting in Britain. He basically carving up countries he'd never been to and would never visit. And there is a lot of truth to that. You know, so many of the border problems happening at flashpoints around the world are... They were handcrafted by an elite British man in the past. These artisan borders, handmade.
You know, the United States has damaged the world in a lot of ways. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah, it's fresh. Those are fresh wounds.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the United States, though, our perspective on that is either a kind of willful ignorance or a sort of shame / resentment. There's not a lot of laughing self-examination.
Yeah, because the problem America has is that, you know, you're still at the top. When everything's gone, and listen, it kills me to say this, but the British Empire is gone. It depends whether or not you count the Falkland Islands, and nobody does. There is innate ludicrousness to the fact that the greatness of the British Empire is an echo of the past. And you can't. It makes national pride more difficult.
You know, I'm always surprised when American exceptionalism becomes a political issue, in the sense that it is an accusation hurled against many politicians.
It's amazing
that they insufficiently believe that America is the greatest country in the world.
I love it. I love it. It's amazing. Because there is honestly part of me that really does love it, because it's positive. Like, there's no point to being negative all the time. And that's been a tough lesson to learn moving to this country, because in Britain you're fired in the kiln of negativity, because everything's gone, everything's terrible, what's the point? There's something overwhelmingly positive about America saying, this is the greatest, we are the greatest. The problem is when you take it one step further, and where you'll get, like, this president... saying America is the greatest country in the history of the world. That's where you want to go, whoa there. Whoa. In the history, that is a much bigger discussion. And there's part of me that, there's part of me that really loves that. That just relentless feeling of number one forever. And in the past as well. I prefer living closer to this than to the British idea of life is pointless. We are dust in the wind of history.
Do you feel like your 10 years in the United States has changed you personally?
Yeah, probably along those lines. Yeah, probably. Yeah, it probably has. I love it here. I guess that could seem odd coming from someone who criticizes, America and what it does so much, but it comes from a point of love. Like, the frustration is amplified when America is still, I do think, the greatest. It's built on the greatest idea. You know, if you look at the Statue of Liberty and what's written underneath it, it is no one can't get behind that. Has it changed me? It has definitely changed me, because there is a positivity to America which is infectious in a good way. that, yeah, I would have thought that I had, was inoculated against through, yeah, basically 3 decades of being British, but some of it has got through.
After a break, John Oliver talks about going to the Republican National Convention and meeting the love of his life. What? It's super romantic. Stick around. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Basecamp wants to thank Bullseye and everyone dedicated to making great things. Whether alone or with a team, Basecamp is a simple, easy-to-learn tool for working on projects. You can try it on your own projects free for 60 days at basecamp.com/bullseye.
Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Give the Latino USA podcast from NPR a listen. Latino USA covers current and emerging issues impacting Latinos and other people of color. Reporting on how people live, struggle with, and celebrate difference, Latino USA chronicles how Latinos are living, shaping, and changing America. Find Latino USA now at iTunes.com/NPR.
It's Bullseye, and I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to John Oliver. In 2014, John graduated from senior British correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart to host of his own HBO show, Last Week Tonight. That show returns for its second season this week. I only recently learned that you met your wife at the Republican National Convention.
I did.
Can you describe to me the circumstances?
Well, I was there. It was the 2008 election. And so we were shooting at the RNC on a layer of the convention center that we were not supposed to be on, because that's where all the people that you have any interest in interviewing are. So we would put our camera equipment through with the caterer's equipment each morning, and then we would find this back exit, and we'd usually have a few hours of interviewing people before we were chased out of the building. But I was concerned because I was on a visa back then, going back to what we were talking about before, and it's, you know, if you get arrested on a visa, you are gone, you're done. So I could never get arrested on field pieces, which can be problematic, because you kind of do want to take it up to that line and beyond it sometimes, just, you know, for sometimes that's where the most interesting thing is. It's something that is not strictly allowed in the legal sense. And yeah, my wife was in the army. She's an Iraq war veteran. And so she was at both conventions with a veterans group. And when they saw us getting chased by security, they hid us in their little booth. And so then they, like, the security guards flew past Keystone Cops style. And that was it. I didn't see her again for like 6 months or so on, but that was where I met her, in the least romantic place on earth. Whatever the opposite of a romantic story is, that's what it is.
It is a pretty solid thing for any foreign satirical comedian to like show up at an event next to a beautiful American veteran.
Yeah. I'm incredibly proud of her and her service. I'm incredibly proud of her fighting in a war that I was against at the time. Well, I was and remain against. And she's, yeah, I'm so proud of her, and everyone she served with. They're amazing, amazing people. But yeah, I guess it is, people are surprised. But I guess there are so many other things for them to be surprised about when they see us together. And the first one is probably physical, and they probably don't get beyond that. The idea of why are you with him is initially physical, and I think that's so bamboozling to people that they never even get down into, oh, that's interesting, you fought a war and he's a comedian, and I get that. But just on a physical level, how are you with him? What? that kind of confuses people enough that it never goes deeper than that.
You're a very handsome man, John.
Jesse, that is biologically not true. That's not true. There's no need for you to say that. I remember George Clooney was a guest on The Daily Show, and I met him, and his face is so wonderful. He's got such a great face. You know, it's where humans' facial features are supposed to be. And I remember I spoke to him, and I went upstairs and I looked in the mirror, and everything looked a mess. You should end up like just kind of feeling your own face going, this is, none of this is right. This is all wrong. This isn't where anything is supposed to, it's not supposed to kind of be pointing out like that. That's supposed to be higher. They're supposed to be smaller. What is going on down there? It just does. It just, you know, I have to be funny, Jesse. George Clooney does not have to be funny. There's no.
He is, though. That's the worst part.
It's even worse. Exactly. Because he chooses to be.
Give me a break, Clooney.
Yeah.
Man, how great would it be if you could just sell every joke on your show with a twinkle in your eye?
That's right. If you could just get to the end of whatever segment we were doing and then just do a kind of smoky look into camera which made everyone feel safe.
Well, John, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on Bullseye. It was really great to get to talk to you.
It's a pleasure, Jesse. Thanks so much.
John Oliver. His show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver returns to HBO this Sunday. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. On their advice podcast, My Brother, and Me, the McElroy brothers answer all kinds of questions, usually a little seriously and a little ridiculously. Since Bullseye's a show about culture, we have the McElroys on from time to time to solve your cultural quandaries. They're on the line right now to do just that. Justin, Travis, Griffin, McElroy, welcome back to Bullseye.
Hey, thanks.
What a genuine pleasure it is.
Here's a question from Graham. What classics do I have to read to not appear dumb?
Fudge, Super Fudge.
Mega Fudge.
Mega Fudge, Super Duper Fudge.
Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, Tales of a 40-Year-Old Nothing. That one's dark. That one gets dark.
I think if you have to ask this question, you might already be dumb. Sorry.
You're just putting a nail in this guy's coffin right away. That doesn't seem fair.
I mean, accept it. Embrace it. Like, when you say classics you have to read, like, you can not read and still be wicked smart, I bet, the person said for the first time on NPR.
There are lots of tips and tricks you can use to actually avoid having to read the book. If someone asks you, for example, if you've read Dante's Inferno, you can reply, not in English, because that is a really great diversion.
And I guess that's accurate.
By the time you figure it out, you just jump out the window.
Or you always just say, like, I did once, but it's been a really long time. Mm-hmm. And then you, like, throw down a smoke bomb and you run away.
Yeah. It's unimpeachable, that tactic.
Here's a question from Twitter user @AskVampire. My boss suggested we play a video game together sometime. Should I do this, and do I let him win?
It depends on the video game, right, doesn't it? Because if you're playing like a very competitive first-person shooter video game, things might get pretty heated. Things might get a little... I mean, I guess things inherently will be, yes, kind of violent.
You know, @AskVampire did say that he or she will be playing Civilization V.
Okay. Well, in that game, you can accrue culture points by having famous playwrights live in your culture by which you can win. So I think in terms of video game, like, cordialness, it's pretty hard to beat Civilization V.
Oh, you got Leonardo da Vinci. Oh.
Yeah, any game that can conclude with, I got Shakespeare, is not going to create a lot of contention. Seems like a fine choice. It is very long, which is problematic because that's a lot of the time with the boss man that you're not getting compensated for, and you should think about whether or not that's worth it to you.
You should play the video game with your boss and then try to clock those hours the next day.
Just turn in the time card and see what happens?
Wow. I cannot think of many more awkward exchanges than, boss, I was under the impression that that was a work activity.
Was that not a trust-building thing? Or?
Here's another cultural question for you, McElroy brothers. Sam asks, should I go to a concert by myself if my friends won't join me?
Why won't your friends join you?
It's probably a chap hop concert.
it just seems to me like that should be a pretty good, like, canary in the mine situation. If your friend's like, oh, no.
I would never do that.
Oh, God, no. You shouldn't go to that concert either.
I think everybody at a concert is, whoa. Everybody at a concert is fundamentally alone, right? I mean, you're just standing in a group of other people. all fixated on the same musical artist and just mm-hmm. trying to escape it, trying to be part of a community. Also, you know what's nice about not going with friends is that you don't have to have that awkward, like, am I gesticulating more than they are check? Am I singing along to a song that they just are nodding along to? That gets very awkward.
I like having that bellwether in such close proximity. I like taking friends to concerts because then I know I have a trusted source to, like, bounce my own, like, terrible dancing against. Mm-hmm. Like, if they're doing it worse than me, then I can just, like, I can keep doing the Cabbage Patch.
No, but think about it, Griffin. If you're alone, you can be freed from the societal pressures. You're a one-man wrecking crew. You feel the tension of the dance as James Taylor's Mexico builds to its sort of
sure.
musical climax. And you can be the one that ignites the dancing. You'd be that guy, the party starter, Twisted Fire starter.
Without a friend there, who's to stop you from sleeping with the lead singer?
Exactly. What if you score one VIP pass and you can have your dream night with James Taylor?
Mm-hmm. But you don't have your friend to go, no, you can't. What would your wife think?
I need a ride home. What would your dad think? He loves James Taylor. He'll be so disappointed you didn't invite him.
The McElroy brothers, Justin, Griffin, and Travis, host My Brother, and Me. It is a free podcast. You can find it in your favorite podcatching software like iTunes, or you can find it on our website, MaximumFun.org. McElroys, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Been a pleasure.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This is Bullseye. When Stephen Colbert announced he was stepping away from the Colbert Report, Comedy Central cast their net for a new nightly host. They settled on someone close to home, The Daily Show correspondent Larry Wilmore. Wilmore has just launched the new program. It's called The Nightly Show. Before his time with Jon Stewart, Wilmore wrote for The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and In Living Color. He also created The Bernie Mac Show and co-created The PJs with Eddie Murphy. The Nightly Show is a kind of mix of The Daily Show and a political panel show. Here's a little bit of one of Wilmore's monologues.
Now, many critics have called the recent black protests unfocused. I won't mention any names. Oprah. Sorry, I had something stuck in my stepman. It was a... not calling anybody out. But, and, you know, in fairness, it's not completely inaccurate. You see, it's not that these protests are less focused. It's just that the goals are less tangible. In the old days, it was about being able to sit at a lunch counter or going to the same schools or even voting. Today, we're just trying to not get shot on our way to work. Now, look, I know it sounds like I'm exaggerating. People may think, hey, come on, Larry, calm down, calm down. Police aren't targeting black guys. Okay. Row 122.
Tonight, a South Florida family is outraged by this image right here and others. They say North Miami Beach police used it and the images of five other minorities as targets during weapons training.
People that are out there supposed to be protecting us are using us as target practice.
That story was reported way back in today. Okay. The police in Florida are literally using pictures of young black men as targets. Now, how can we see that and be surprised when it happens in real life? I'm not surprised when Kobe hits a jumper. That dude practices. We'll be right back.
Wilmore and I spoke in 2009. You started out as a stand-up comic. Did mm-hmm. did you start out as a stand-up comic as a way to, you know, showcase yourself for
yeah, sure.
Hollywood, or because stand-up was the form that you thought you were going to do for the rest of your career?
It's funny. Back in those days, as we say, as we get a little older, stand-up was kind of its own thing. I mean, it was huge back then, and you kind of did it to be a stand-up. You know, that was the thing you wanted to do, was to be a good stand-up. You didn't see it as, I want to get my 5 minutes to hopefully get a sitcom. You know, you really wanted to be a comedian, and that's what I wanted to do. But also, I was interested in other things at the time. I was a theater major in college. And my first gig was at the Mark Tate Performs Improvisational Theater Project. It was this theater thing where we wrote a play through improv. So I was, my first union was Actors Equity. So I have a very strong theatrical background, actually. So when I started doing stand-up, which I did because I was a little frustrated going to auditions and having to read for certain types of roles, and I thought I should kind of write my own thing. You know, I also had that other side of me that wanted to do more serious writing or explore more bigger things, you know. And so after doing stand-up for a while, I decided I wanted to write for television to kind of get that out of me.
And that's when you got the gig writing for Rick Dees?
Yeah, that's right. I feel like I'm on Inside the Actor's Studio.
That's a
like,
big...
How did you know that?
I feel like I saw that credit on your resume. It's such an outlier. I felt like I could hardly not bring up
very
the fact that
outlier.
You wrote for... Now, you wrote for Rick Dees' short-lived...
You have to be an outlier to write for Rick Dees, by the way.
His short-lived late-night... TV talk show.
Yes. Rick Dees, a really nice guy, though he scared me once when I asked him what his favorite song was. And he said, the number one song on the chart. And I go, the number one song? What is the number one song? He said, no. Whatever song is the number one is my favorite. And I was like, ouch.
Was that your actual, like, first writing gig?
First television writing gig. Before that, I used to write jokes for comedians and that kind of thing. And, and it just kind of led to that. So,
what were you writing on the Rick Dees television show? Did he have like a monologue?
Yeah, you know, it was more like a soliloquy, you know, because it was more like him, a naked deer in the headlights on stage. I don't know. So, it was more like strange interlude or something, you know, than an actual monologue. But you know, it was fun. The thing is, you had to learn how to. Deliver something every single day. And that was the best thing about it. But I was only there for about 6 months. Then I got the job in A Living Color.
And A Living Color is something that I'm sure that was not just changing your career, as I'm sure it did, but was kind of changing TV at the time.
Absolutely. I felt it was the first show to bring hip-hop culture into the mainstream. The only other show at the time was probably Arsenio. But America, for the most part, they didn't know what hip-hop was, you know. And Living Color kind of just swept that right in with the Fly Girls and kind of the clothing, the just the whole vibe and the look of it. And think about the people that came out of there. Jamie Foxx, I mean, J-Lo, Rosie Perez, Jim Carrey. I mean, so many stars came out of that show. It was amazing. As well as the Wayans brothers, which there are 15 of them, by the way.
What was it like to get added to that staff? Because by the time you joined the gang, it was already clearly something that was important.
Well, it had a bit of a turnover right there. I mean, it was very competitive and it was tough holding on to your job. In fact, Keenan was like Murphy Brown. He fired his assistant every week, literally, you know. And so it was a very tough competitive environment and you really had to work hard to survive, which once again teaches you big lessons too. But so when I got in there, the first wave of writers, there were only a couple of writers from the first season who were still around. In fact, there may have only been one. So a lot of the original writers had kind of moved in.
Do you remember anything that you wrote on the show? Like, for example, the first thing that you got on the air as a new writer?
Sure. The one that kind of saved my job, actually, because you always felt you were going to get fired, like I said. But I wrote a sketch for Keenan called Jesse Jackson's Children's Books. And it was Jesse Jackson doing his version of the Dr. Seuss books, like Hop on Cop, you know, or How the Grinch Stole My Stereo, you know, it was that kind of thing, you know. And he really enjoyed it a lot, and it got big laughs, so that was cool.
Did you feel like the voice of that show was...
Horton Hears a Hoe. So that was a good one. I was like, I know there's a hoe who's down there, and what's more, quite likely there's two, even three, even four. A whole family of hoes who hoe to survive. Don't be like a hoe, just keep hope alive. You know? So that was kind of the way his book went.
What were you thinking of when you created the PJs?
I've always been drawn to satire, and if it's not there, I feel like it needs to be there. It's kind of my perspective on things. I kind of fell into it, to be honest with you. I had just signed my first overall deal with Disney and looking to do a project. I was approached about, someone called me and said Eddie Murphy was interested in doing an animated show, and at first I thought they meant a Saturday morning cartoon, and I was like, well, I don't think I want to do that. Why is Eddie doing that, you know? And when I found out more about it, I found out that it was with Brian Grazer and Ron Howard and, you know, Imagine. And it was actually a primetime show they were interested in doing. And so I went ahead and took the meeting. And the idea that Eddie had, Eddie said he was kind of tired of the way sitcoms looked at the time, that
it was the same kind of living room and the same kind of family, the same kind of set.
Did you know him when you met him?
No, it's the first time I met him. And he said he just wanted to do something different. And that's all he had in mind. And he got the idea. It's funny, he and Ron Howard kind of, or Brian Grazer kind of, saw the same thing and got inspired in different ways. Ron Howard was doing Apollo 13 at the time, and he was watching this old show called The Thunderbirds. I don't know if you remember that. I mean,
sure.
Before your time.
Marionette, yes, it's marionettes. Show.
Oh, when I was a kid, it was very cool, you know, these marionettes in space. And Eddie had watched it, too, independently of them. He was doing Nutty Professor with Brian. And he said, oh, it'd be cool to do something like that, you know, with puppets in the projects or something. And, you
that
know,
story really came alive with that.
Right, I thought, you know, it's radio.
Sure, might
nobody
as well.
Know. They may think he's here.
He is. See you later, Eddie. Thanks for stopping by.
So that was the simple idea, puppets in the projects. That's all Eddie had. And he had thought of there, maybe there should be a super character. And, you know, I think he had like a white guy who still lived there. It was this angry racist guy that somehow still lived in the projects. Those are like the two characters. So anyhow, I got involved and pulled my friend Steve Tompkins to do it with me because he had done Simpsons and The Critic and worked with me in Living Color. And I thought it'd be great to work with him. And that's how it started. And Steve and I pretty much just developed the show out of those simple ideas.
I remember being really struck by it. I mean, I grew up in a very inner city context. And uh-huh. I remember just being struck by seeing that on TV. Right.
Yeah, I don't think it was anywhere else. And Steve and I really thought of it as a satire. You know, our not really a Black Simpsons, but really was a satire of that whole, the way people view the projects and just the way that it's talked about, you know, and the image that it has more than the authentic life itself.
Breakfast coming up. Oh, yes, coffee's ready, too. I'm sorry, we're out of Sunny D. Chitlins? Why would you want chitlins for breakfast?
I was clearing my throat. We got chitlins.
I'll finish my conversation with Larry Wilmore after a break. He'll talk about landing gigs writing with Bernie Mac and Eddie Murphy. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Give the Latino USA podcast from NPR a listen. Latino USA covers current and emerging issues impacting Latinos and other people of color, reporting on how people live, struggle with, and celebrate difference. Latino USA chronicles how Latinos are living, shaping, and changing America. Find Latino USA now at iTunes.com/NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This is Bullseye. My guest is the writer, comedian, and TV producer Larry Wilmore. He's the host of Comedy Central's new late-night program, The Nightly Show.
I want to ask you about writing for Bernie Mac. What was it like the first time that you saw Bernie Mac do stand-up?
Well, it's funny because I met Bernie Mac when I was doing the PJs. We used to have to go and find Eddie wherever he was and get him to record something. It's kind of like your radio show, just to, yeah. You know, here in your house. And sometimes we'd go to his trailer on a movie set. Sometimes we'd go to Sacramento where he had a house, and we'd do it in a studio up there. Sometimes we'd fly to New Jersey in his house called Bubble Hill, and we'd do it there. He had his own studio. So Steve and I were used to traveling where
Eddie was. It's called Bubble Hill?
Bubble Hill, that's his estate.
It's an excellent name for an estate.
Oh, it's great, you know. And so anyhow, we were on the set of Life, the movie that Eddie did with Martin Lawrence, and Bernie had a small part in it, and he was just sitting around, and we were waiting for Eddie, you know. And I go up to him and said, hey, Bernie, I'm a big fan. He goes, oh, hey, man, how you doing? And he was really, really nice. And I said, Bernie, I would love to write for you one day. He said, oh, man, that would be great. He said, come see me at the amphitheater. I'm going to be there the other week. And I was like, okay, cool. And I thought, I think he thinks I want to write for his stand-up. I want to write something for him, you know. That's what I was thinking, and I think he thought for a stand-up. And when I got the idea a couple of years after that, just from watching reality television, I got an idea to do a show that felt real. That was kind of, you know, the thing you were talking about where Black shows kind of went in the 90s, I wanted to go the opposite direction, go to a more realistic feel of a show, you know, that didn't have action kind of pushed at us, where we were more drawn in. So you felt the kids really did have a dilemma of their mom being on crack. This is the opposite of the PJs now, where it's not a joke. It's the reality of it sucks you in emotionally. And so because you have this feeling for these children, Bernie can get away with anything.
you know, as the guy who's taking care of these kids. You're going to love him from the beginning, you know. And seeing Bernie's act in the Kings of Comedy where, you know, he talked about taking care of the kids and everything. It was the funniest thing I'd seen at the time. He said, I believe you should be able to hit a kid in the throat or the stomach, you know. In the throat or the stomach. But I believe, come on, Charlotte, you know what I'm talking about. You know, he'd say that. It was so funny, you know. And I thought that, you know, I just thought that would be a good premise for kind of the feel that I had. I pitched the show to Bernie, and he was taking several pitches at the time. People were pitching him different things. And that's when he was just getting hot from Kings of Comedy. And he liked the idea, and then I pitched it to Fox and sold it there. So.
He was such an amazing performer in that he could balance the emotion you talked about, that he could show the emotion you talked about while being like probably the most ferocious performer of stand-up comedy that I've ever seen in my entire life.
I agree with that. And it was the reason why I had to have the show single camera, which was a really tough sell. And even to the last second, even after it was shot, when it was going to put on the air, they still wanted to put it in front of an audience, and I had to fight. And eventually ended up getting fired because of all those fights that I had with Fox. But I knew I couldn't compete with Bernie Mac, the comedian. And if I was in front of an audience, I'd be competing with that Bernie Mac all the time, where he'd have to have that kind of energy and have to be telling those type of jokes. I thought if I made it single camera, I can be more introspective with Bernie. We can get to know a different Bernie, instead of Bernie Mac, Bernard McCulloch, which is Bernie's real name. And that's the experience that I wanted the audience to have, who this guy really is, what is really motivating him. The theme of the show was kids are terrorists, and I don't negotiate with terrorists. That was the theme of the show, basically. And so I needed to pull that out in every single scene that we were dramatizing. And so it couldn't just be jokey. You had to really get in there and feel what he was feeling. And one of the keys to the show turned out to be... when Bernie did his stand-up, and he was in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he treated the crowd like they were one person, you know, he would say, Charlotte, you know what I'm talking about. You know what Bernie, Charlotte, you know what Bernie Mac is saying. And I thought that would be a good hook for the show to just do America and treat America like they were his best friend. And like, America, you know what Bernie Mac is saying. You know, I don't really hate those kids, you know. And that would be a nice device for the emotional door to the show, you know. And it turned out to work like that.
I'm here to tell you that I'm going to kill one of them kids. Oh, don't get me wrong. I love them. They my blood. I give them the shirt off my back. You ever see a chicken with his neck run, laying to the side all lazy and weak? That's what I'm going to do to them kids. Talk back to me one more time. Snap. I'm going to snap their neck off. They're too sassy. They're too grown today. They talk back too much. Yeah, I know what you're saying, man. I don't care what you're talking about. Bernie Mac crew, Bernie Mac beat his kids. I don't care. That's your opinion. Because you don't know the story. You don't know what went down. And they're not my kids.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This is Bullseye. My guest is the writer, comedian, and TV producer Larry Wilmore. He's the host of Comedy Central's new late-night program, The Nightly Show.
I want to ask you, as a writer who had been so successful as a writer, why in your 40s did you decide...
But I become a struggling actor?
Yeah, exactly. Why did you go back to being a performer? I mean, you had done a little bit of performing along the way here and there, the occasional guest spot on a TV show, but it seems like you recommitted yourself to performance, not just with The Daily Show, but, you know, you did several episodes of The Office, you think about doing stand-up again, that kind of thing.
I eventually would like to be a waiter. That is my goal. I didn't want to just create a talk show for myself because I felt like, well, I haven't performed in a while. And I need that connection with the audience before I make that move. And so we saw The Daily Show as a way to kind of get paid training, you know, kind of work in front of the audience, build a rapport.
Paid training on one of the top five shows on television.
Exactly. You got to shoot for the stars, man. And I was very, very fortunate. The timing of it couldn't have been better, that when I thought of that, they were looking for that.
Did you have an idea of who your persona was on The Daily Show when you pitched it?
No, not at all. Because, first of all, it's a credit to how talented Colbert and Carell were. I mean, Colbert is so funny and such a big personality, you can't help but hear that voice in your head when you're thinking about what a correspondent is. I didn't want to be... You know, I didn't want to have the ghetto perspective. I felt that had been done before, you know, black as victim. And I didn't want to do the opposite of that. Like, I'm some black Republican who doesn't believe any of this stuff, you know, or whatever, or is always the opposite point of view. And so I needed to find something that was closer to me, which I'm more of a contrarian, you know. I'll take a point of view just to have a debate, whether I believe in it or not, you know. And it's just kind of my sense of humor to be contrary more than to be opposite, you know. But when we wrote, we were going to write a couple of bits, and they were going to tape one and keep it and then show the other one live. And my dress rehearsal went horrible. I mean, I died the death of deaths. And keep in mind, I'm basically auditioning on the air. You know, if I flop, chances are they weren't going to call me back. And no one would have even known I was ever on The Daily Show. So I was very nervous. And while I was doing it, by the way, the crew wouldn't even look at me. They weren't even making eye contact. They're thinking, this guy's not going to last. You know? But anyhow, John was so nice. During the, they have like a rewrite right before air, and I didn't know that. And he called me into the room. I thought, okay, they're probably going to cancel both of them. And he said, Larry, let's get rid of the second one. Let's just concentrate on one. And we're going to rewrite it. And I said, and just put it in your own words. Let's do it. And so John and I rewrote that one, just saying it back and forth to each other and kind of making each other laugh. And what I had written was a little too writerly, you know. And I got to just do it with John and make it more of my own voice naturally, instinctively. And right before air, when we were sitting there, he looked at me and said, Larry, just look in the camera. Just effing give it to America. Just do that. Yeah. And it was so nice. And when I did it, the first thing I did got a huge laugh, and it killed from there. They said it was one of the biggest responses they got from a guy on his first time. Now the crew is like, what the F? We thought this guy wasn't funny.
Is there a particular piece that you've done in the last couple of years as a regular correspondent that you're particularly proud of?
I guess my all-time favorite is the one I did with John Oliver when a councilman wanted to ban the N-word in New York, which is a true thing. And we tortured that guy. It was so much fun. The piece on TV was maybe 2 minutes, maybe. We tortured him for a good hour. Hour of torture. And John and I had some jokes we were going to do, but most of that hour was John and I just improvising and torturing him. You know, and it was one of the funnest things.
So, Leroy, you want to ban this word, Larry? Thank you. What he said. Is the word offensive to everyone or just to... No. I was just pointing out. Okay. Don't use that term, please.
It's offensive to everyone. Young people are using a word with no meaning, so we're asking people to voluntarily stop using the N-word.
A voluntary ban. It's like renouncing sweets for Lent.
And it is the dessert of racial slurs.
Oh, John.
Isn't it?
No, you can't say that. Come on.
I didn't,
You said dessert. You equated the N-word to a dessert.
Sorry, Larry.
That's horrible.
Sorry. I'm sorry. Oh, I didn't, God.
Because it's chocolate?
No, it's not.
Larry Wilmore. He's the host of the newly launched Nightly Show on Comedy Central, which is appropriately titled The Nightly Show.
Every week on the show, we like to close with a recommendation from me, your host. It's The Outshot. There is only one greatest pop song of all time, and I'm going to be honest with you because I think you deserve it. The race isn't even close. Number two is like 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,
makes literally anyone happy. You could play it for Israelis and Palestinians. You could play it for deep Amazonians who've never heard a record. Or for all I care, you could play it for mole people deep under the crust of the earth, and you would get one reaction. Happiness. Absolute clapping, dancing, wide smiling joy. It's a song so good, it even stands up to a ridiculous introduction like that one. Nick, if you would, drop the needle. It's hard to say what makes this song so perfect, besides that it's perfect. One of the great things about pop is that there doesn't have to be a reason, just a feeling, and this one feels right. It's a great Motown band, a carefully crafted tune by the Corporation, and Michael Jackson, the greatest ever. At 10, you could hear the joy he took in music.
Stand out in a crowd, but someone kick you from the bunch.
that his vocal isn't just a statement. Michael was always too vulnerable for that. It's more of a question, an invitation to join him in the feeling of warmth and escape that we get from pop music. Come on, doesn't get any better than this. Actually, you know what? Nick, just turn it up. I want to enjoy it. That's my outshot. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. The show's produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Senior producer at MaximumFun.org is Colin Anderson. Our outgoing senior producer is Nick White. Nick and I have been working together for about 12 years now, since Nick was the associate news director at KZSC-FM in Santa Cruz, and I was the news director. Nick went on to become station manager, so he topped me there. And this show wouldn't be what it is today if it weren't for Nick's contributions. Nick's going on to a great new job at a great station, KCRW in Los Angeles, and I just want to take this opportunity to thank Nick for the many, many years of hard work that he's done on this show and all of the work that he's done to make me look better. I'm very grateful to have had Nick's partnership in this effort, and we'll miss him very much here. So thank you, Nick, for what you've done on the show and for being such a great friend. All our interstitial music is provided to us by Dan Wally. He said, clearing his throat, if you'd like to hear any of our past programs, they're all free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And if you want to hear about cool culture stuff between now and the next time Bullseye airs, you can find us on Facebook and click like. That's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist-owned.
Listener supported.